Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, Obamacare premiums are dropping in many states. Why? And what's happening on the private health insurance market? The window to enroll in MNsure or other ACA health insurance, if you live in a different state, opens on November 1st. And despite rumors of the early demise of the ACA, including that it was a, quote, train wreck headed for a death spiral, more states are adding plans to their coverage and premiums are starting to drop. At least the rate of growth of those premiums is decreasing. Here in Minnesota, MNsure premiums are expected to drop by anywhere between 7 and 27%, and some employer-sponsored health insurance costs have leveled out, too. So here's the question. Are those decreases in premiums because more of us are paying out of pocket for our health care through high deductibles and co-pays? What's really happening in the health insurance market? Is this stable? Is this just a one-time blip on when it comes to health insurance premiums? So two guests and your experience too. If you buy health insurance for your family on the MNsure exchange, have you been struggling to pay for rising premiums? And what will the decrease mean for your household budget? If you get your health care through your job, is your insurance getting more affordable? How are you managing those health care costs? So I want to hear from you if you're on the exchange, you're getting it through MNsure. Also curious to hear what is happening out there in the private health insurance market. You're getting it through your job. Maybe your company is self-insured. I want to know what's going on with premiums there and what this means for your own household budget. Are you spending more on the deductibles and the co-pays? Talk to me about that as well. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Our guest today, Catherine Hempstead, is a senior policy advisor at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, where she directs their work on health policy. And she's with us today from where? In Washington. Hey, Catherine. Hi. Good to have you on the show.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you.
Dr. Renee Critchlow is with us. She's with me in the studio. She's a physician and assistant professor in family medicine at the University of M Medical School. Good to have you here, Dr. Critchlow. Welcome.
Well, thanks.
Catherine, is healthcare getting any cheaper overall in America, or are we seeing the rate of growth of premiums decline because we're all spending more out of pocket?
Well, I think it's a pretty safe rule lately that healthcare never gets cheaper. It only can get expensive more or less quickly, depending on the situation. You know, we just released a report about employer-sponsored insurance and trends in those costs.
I read that report. Yes.
Yeah, and actually, it was came from Minnesota. Came from Shadac in Minnesota,
right.
And you know, did show some moderation in growth rates in the last year or two. I think that's different than what we're seeing in the ACA marketplace, which is so much more volatile.
And okay, tell me why.
Well, I mean, I think there is a much more volatile business narrative in the individual market because the market's fairly new and the customers are new, the sellers are new, a lot of the sellers are new, and I think there's been a process of sort of calibration and trying to figure out how to make the product. And I'm sure, as you know, a lot of carriers lost money, left the market, others
yes.
have come in, and so there's been this sort of, you know, volatile business narrative, and then at the same time, obviously, there's been a very volatile political narrative where there's been different attempts in recent years to make the market more challenged, removing the cost-sharing reduction payment, changes in support for outreach and enrollment, you know, so this story is pretty well known. So I think that those two trajectories have made the price trends in the ACA marketplace pretty different than the employer-sponsored market, which is more of kind of a slow-moving, you know, ship. Not that there isn't something interesting to talk about there, but it's sort of two different stories. But we are seeing this year in the ACA marketplace, we are seeing some really nice premium reductions in some states and some very, very moderate growth rates at or below trend in lots of other states. So I think that is definitely an interesting story.
Dr. Critchlow, one of the things that I've read about why the ACA premiums might be coming down is that they went up so fast and so far because there was so much uncertainty in the market, in the ACA market. And that is why we see them leveling off. Is that a factor in this?
Well, as mentioned, one of the biggest issues is the volatility. But not only the volatility in the insurance market, but also the fragmentation of our approach to our healthcare system. We have, you know, in my own clinic, we have a payer mix of Medicaid, Minsure, private insurance. And even within those categories, you have people that have things like the high deductible plans. I have patients who won't come to me until it's going to be very expensive because they have this high deductible plan.
We actually have a show planned on high deductibles coming in. What I think I hear you saying is you've got a combination of health insurance options and payment modes, and there's a lot of volatility between them.
Yeah, and it also, the patient mix that's within them.
Got it.
Each of those different fragmented health systems have a different level of risk with their patients.
Okay.
And one of the things that they were trying to do with the ACA was spread out the risk.
Right.
By incorporating healthy people that
younger,
would also be
healthy.
Would pay in as they were younger and healthy. And as they got older and less healthy, they would also be covered because the pool would be so wide that the costs would be lower.
Has it worked that way?
Well, there's been a lot of things that politically have impacted that. And the idea that we're getting more fragmentation with more and more politicization of the ACA.
Okay.
It's not a perfect thing. It was intended to expand the risk for both the insurance market and mm-hmm. and the people, the patients, so that they would have a lower rate, but it would spread the risk across a greater pool of patients. And we don't have that as much as it would have.
We don't have the risk spread as far out because of some of the things that the Trump administration has been doing as far as enrollment, et cetera.
Yeah.
Catherine, before we go to the calls here, I do want to ask about the risk pool because that was a big key to how the ACA was going to work. And as Dr. Critchlow was saying, the idea was to spread the risk around. Are we seeing any indication that the risk pool is getting closer to what was imagined with the ACA, and that is having an effect on premiums?
Well, that's a good question. I think there are different answers in different states. I mean, I do think, just getting back to your question about why we saw rates go down this year and, you know, versus being so high last year. Last year was a kind of a funny year. A lot of insurers bailed. There were a lot of sort of existential concerns about whether there was even going to be coverage offered in certain places. But at the same time, I think there was a subset of carriers in the market that had actually learned how to make money in the market and how to make the product and succeed. And I think that they did very well last year. Other carriers watched them. And I think that, you know, that has encouraged a lot of entry. And a lot of the entry is expansion by some of those existing players who know how to sell the product in this market. So I think that that's one of the reasons that we've seen some spreading of, you know, entry and more enthusiasm on the supply side this year. And in terms of the risk pool, I do think that in some places people have said that some of the initial really, really high needs of people that have been uninsured for a long time have kind of, you know, settled down. And then in some places the population is a little bit less expensive to serve than it had been in the past. So that is something that has been noted in some places, but there is a lot of churn in this market. So there's about, you know, a third of the enrollees are new every year. So there's always some new people coming in.
I just want to make sure that we clarify that here. What I thought I heard you just say was part of this is there were people that hadn't had health care, hadn't had insurance for a long time. They weren't getting what year-to-year health care. They came in, they needed a lot of health care, and some of that has leveled out. And that may be a factor here too.
It's different in every state because I think the sort of the population of people who are potentially eligible for and responsive to this offer of ACA coverage is differs geographically
for
depending on sort of what the labor market's like and whether there's Medicaid and, you know, other things. But yes, I think as a stylized fact, that is definitely something that people have noted.
Okay, let me take some calls here to Shane in southern Minnesota. Hi, Shane.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. How does this work for you in your household?
You know, health insurance has, I'm experiencing just increasing every single year. And I mean, I work for the government, and it used to be people wanted to work for the government for great health care.
Uh-huh.
I'm experiencing the exact opposite, $500 a month plus a $5,000 annual deductible. My
wow.
son has autism, and so we reach that every year. It's been quite a struggle in our household.
So just to be clear here, the premiums that you're, the health coverage that you're getting through your work with a local government are getting more expensive.
That's correct.
And you're dealing with this $5,000 deductible.
Yep.
Wow. You know, we have a show, a specific show planned just on deductibles, but before we came on the air, Dr. Critchlow and I were talking about these deductible plans. You see a lot of patients that are in this situation with Shane, aren't you?
Yeah, and it's fortunate that he's got the ability to have this insurance, but the fact that you have such a large deductible, a lot of folks won't go to the doctor until they're sure they're going to blow through that deductible. And it's very sad because we need to see people earlier. As a full-spectrum family physician, the earlier I can see someone in the course of any illness or injury, the more likelihood that we can have an impact on it.
Do you have any thoughts about why his health insurance rates, why he's not seeing this decline in premiums that other Americans are?
It might be due to a change in the level of competition between the insurance companies that that particular employer is going to.
Got it. Meaning there's not enough plans offered.
Yeah, quite possible that that employer only has opportunity to have a limited number of plans to engage with and can't necessarily negotiate for lower rates.
And Catherine, we've alluded to this a couple minutes ago. This is really important when you look at the competition between the plans and what the insured end up paying for those plans, isn't it? Can you describe why?
Yeah, well, I mean, sure. I think when there's a situation where anyone has market power, whether it's a healthcare system, whether it's an insurer, you know, there's a tendency for, you know, for there to be higher prices and, you know, in that setting. And that's why there's concern about consolidation in the healthcare market. Usually the concern is highest when we're talking about consolidation among healthcare systems. And usually the sort of estimates are less when we're talking about health plans. I think that it did happen in the individual market that a lot of places where there was only one carrier, you know, that carrier had to assume all the risk in that area,
yeah.
Priced very conservatively, had a lot of leverage. But there is a backstop in the individual market, which is these MLR rates, so that if actually prices are too high in excess of expenses on medical services, the carriers are obligated to send refunds back to customers. So there is some kind of a, you know, break there to keep carriers from just charging, you know, whatever they think the market can bear. But in terms of deductibles, I just, you know, it has been a trend over the last 10 years or so in employer-sponsored insurance. And I think the individual market is even more extreme in that sense of creating these higher deductible plans, where I think there was a feeling that they just couldn't keep increasing premiums at the rate that they had been increasing them. And the alternative was to sort of push more of the out-of-pocket spending into customers.
Yeah.
It does look like that increase rate of doing that has kind of slowed down a little bit in the last few years, because I think it's reached kind of a breaking point. But I would say in the individual market, and I think it's probably true in employer-sponsored insurance as well, carriers do try to design plans so that sometimes there is some opportunity to go to services and pay copays or coinsurance in advance of meeting the entire deductible.
Mm-hmm.
So when people are shopping for insurance in the individual market, it's important, I think, that they not be sort of hypnotized by the size of the deductible and just assume that they necessarily are going to have to pay that whole amount before they can have any opportunity to do cost sharing, because a lot of times it's not so. A lot of plans offer, you know, three visits or sometimes all primary care visits.
You've kind of got wellness visits, right? That you don't have to pay out for.
Sometimes regular primary care visits, whether it's wellness or not. I mean, that's why it's really important to look at the benefit design and figure out how that deductible is operationalized in your plan.
But I do want to say this. This number kind of floored me. The average deductible for insured employees – has climbed 8 times as fast as wages have gone up in 2008. This is the Kaiser Family Foundation. So to what you just said, Catherine, I mean, some used to argue that, you know, cost sharing was an effective way to try to manage health care and the use of health care, Renee. But I think we're going to hear from people who say, you know, I use it when I need it, and I'm holding back, as I think you've seen, because his deductibles mm-hmm. are so high. Mm-hmm. Renee, weigh in on that, if you would.
Yeah, and I have to say, as someone who I currently work and teach in an urban environment, but prior to that, I lived in rural Montana.
Uh-huh.
And the people that I took care of and that were my friends, it was quite often the case that they would have $5,000, $10,000 deductibles. The idea for them was that's the kind of money that we could maybe scrape together if something really bad happened.
Catastrophic kind of thing.
But now we look at the situation where, I mean, I was just at a conference recently, and there was a presentation. They were talking about how the CEO of GoFundMe said a third of the GoFundMe sites are for healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is a little frightening. And that we're kind of, the fragmentation of our system has provided this kind of service to our patients. I think our patients deserve better. And it is appropriate to look very detailed at the plans you have offered. But I have just was recently talking to one of my friends. She was going on Medicare with her husband. Between them, they have, like, I'd probably say 4 advanced degrees. She's like, this is so opaque. It's so hard to understand. And she's like, I actually have training in this.
And she still can't figure it out?
Yeah. It's,
wow.
It's frightening. And we're expecting people to make these kinds of decisions with numerous plans,
yeah,
and then we're blaming them when something doesn't go right. And I think that's inappropriate.
Catherine, you have a thought on that before I go back to the phones?
Well, I mean, it's definitely true. People hate having high deductibles. And, you know, it is sort of a symptom of the fact that healthcare costs so much, you know, and it's one response, and it's not a response that people like very much. I think having, you know, super, super high premiums instead, you know, has its downsides too. So I think that it's, you know, it's been an attempt to try to moderate premium growth and maybe, you know, create a little bit more of a sort of a market feeling, at least for some healthcare services. But there's clearly a downside, and a lot of people are terrified by the amount of their deductible.
Catherine Hempstead with us from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. She directs their work on health policy. And Dr. Renee Critchlow with us, a physician and from the University of Minnesota. It's a conversation, if you've just gotten in on this, to understand what's happening with premiums, both under the ACA, for us here in Minnesota, MinSure. But I'm also interested in what's happening with premiums through the health insurance that you get through your employer, or if you work for a company that's self-insured, or you self-insure somehow as the head of a company. What are you seeing with premiums? Are you turning more and more often to these high deductible plans? Are you feeling like you're spending more money out of pocket? So getting a sense of the healthcare economics in your household. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieMPR to Nancy in Minneapolis. Nancy, sounds like you're on the exchange. Is that right?
I'm on the MinSure exchange, yes.
How's it look to you?
Well, my husband and I have a small business, and we pay for the two of us $13,000 in deductible each year before we get any care other than a couple of, you know, wellness things.
Okay.
But our actual premiums have gone down because we use an HSA, and we're fortunate enough to, you know, still have the tax deduction protecting our health investment, as we think of it. And it's not good, but if Minnesota went to allowing the small businesses that, you know, are pretty healthy people to be part of the MinSure, Minnesota Care, excuse me, the Minnesota Care program for the working poor, we would spread that risk and we would have a solution. It would bring down those deductibles and it would bring down the premiums. And so I'm really hoping in this next electoral process we have Minnesota Care for everybody that can opt in, like the 150,000 small businesses.
Okay.
that's what I think the solution.
You think that's part of the solution? Let me take this to
the solution, and we should really be advocating for that.
Nancy, I've got that. Thank you, Renee. I want to take that to you. You're nodding and saying you think that's part of the solution. Why?
Well, what Nancy brings up is it's a challenging place because for so long, people who are self-employed, farmers, small business, they've had to self-insure, and at levels that they can't spread their risk across a larger pool. So the idea that they would be able to pay into Minnesota Care, mm-hmm. which is the expanded Medicaid for Minnesota, would provide healthier people in that pool, a larger pool of people, and highly likely lower premiums for the small businessmen and farmers that would be able to get into it. And it's interesting because the Star Tribune did a poll, and 70% of the people they polled, both parties, said that it would be appropriate and a good idea for small business and farmers to be able to buy into the Minnesota Care.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the ideas that people have about how we can incorporate a larger pool of patients and decrease the overall cost for people who are very much at risk. I mean, farmers and small businessmen are one illness away from closing.
Catherine, are there states that do that? And what's the result of that? Go ahead.
Well, I mean, there is a lot of interest in different kinds of quote-unquote Medicaid buy-in plans that many, many states are talking about, ways to try to make Medicaid available to a group of people that wouldn't necessarily be categorically eligible for it or even income eligible, as in this case. And I think that it's incredibly appealing because, Medicaid has lower unit costs, largely because they pay providers lower rates. And, Medicaid also has certain negotiations about discounts for pharmaceuticals that probably wouldn't be able to be extended to some of these other populations. But just sticking with, the lower provider rates, I mean, I think that's really why the Medicaid, the public option, quote unquote, is appealing, because, we've been talking so far this hour about, how, frustrating it is for everybody that healthcare costs so much, and there are, many reasons that healthcare costs so much. But one reason is provider prices, the cost of healthcare services. And so Medicaid is a way to deliver those services less expensively. So there's a lot of interest in Medicaid buy-ins in many different stripes. I think one of the pushbacks that people will get will be from the provider community, the hospitals, the physician groups, who will say, we don't want to trade off those higher reimbursements for Medicaid rates and, in fact, won't necessarily want to participate in that. And then, that becomes a tug of war. So I think that's what makes it difficult to operationalize some of that because, everybody would like to pay less for health care except for the people that get paid to provide health care. They're
exactly.
not as keen on that. So, right. It becomes a negotiation.
Here's some other context on this that I thought was interesting. I just want to throw out some numbers to frame the conversation. Kaiser also came out with 2018, the cost to a family to insure of four through an employer-sponsored plan was $19,600. Now, the family doesn't pay all that. The employer doesn't pay all that. We share the costs, but that is a startling amount of money, Renee. Almost $20,000 a year for a family of four through an employer-sponsored plan, average.
And what you're looking at is when you think about insurance, it's honestly, it's like gambling. You're trying to decide how healthy is my family going to be, what's the risk that something's bad is going to happen, and how much do I want to pay to protect us in case something bad happens. One of the things we see a lot is folks who are just like, I'm going to take the bet and not be insured. And that can
you
be,
see that a lot in your clinic?
Well, we're very fortunate in Minnesota because we've had a very great safety net in this country long before anyone else thought about it.
You mean in the state?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So and in Minnesota, Medicaid has been a very robust thing for decades.
Right.
And in fact, when the ACA entered and people were talking about expanding Medicaid, it didn't really increase that much in our state because we had
so many Minnesotans covered.
Yeah.
Right.
But in states like Kentucky, I mean, yeah, the Medicaid was paying lower rates, but finally rural hospitals were getting paid. So it comes to the point of you're like, we're paying in, we're betting that whether or not we're going to stay healthy or not. And when you have a healthy family and you're still paying $20,000 a year, it can get very frustrating. But when you have that healthy family and one thing goes wrong, it can be life-saving. My son when he was 3 years old, had a retropharyngeal abscess. He was 3 years old and basically had a 5-centimeter abscess in the back of his throat. And we went into the hospital. They took great care of him. And the bill we got was insane.
Like what?
I won't get into the details of it, but part of it was like $17,000. That was just part of it. But the thing is, we were completely insured. We had great coverage. And we paid, I think, $100 for the initial thing. And it was tens of thousands of dollars. And it was out of nowhere. And I'm a physician. I can afford a lot of stuff, but that bill would have gutted us. And families that are just on the edge in dealing with that kind of fear, I think, is the worst part about it. You don't know what's going to happen to your family. You make the bet with the $20,000 that you'll be safe, and then everything goes well, and then you're like, oh, wait, I don't have $20,000.
Conversation here, if you've just tuned in, about premiums, the cost of health care, how many individuals are ending up paying more co-pays and high deductible plans to supplement the cost of health care, and the fact that some of these premiums and some of the plans are coming down. We're talking about what's happening with that as well. We'll get a look at the latest news when we come back, right back to your calls and questions. Back to our conversation now. Renee Critchlow in the studio with me. She's a physician and also an assistant professor in family medicine at the U of M. And Catherine Hempstead, senior policy advisor at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. To David in St. Paul. David, thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while, but I'm glad you did. Hey, are you there? Okay, so David, we'll have to see if we can connect with him again. To Anne in Minnetonka. Hi, Anne.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How does this work in your household?
Well, I am a teacher, and our district is self-insured. Last year, we surprisingly had a premium increase of 15%.
Wow.
Our out-of-pocket, we were all stunned. The teachers were all stunned by it. Our out-of-pocket increased. So we are now, the teacher group, we're looking at pulling out of the self-insured fund and possibly investigating PEEP. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Did you say PEEP?
PEEP, P-E-I-P, Public Employee Insurance Program.
Well, let's see if Catherine knows anything about that. Do you, Catherine?
No, I don't.
Neither does Renee. I'm sorry, Anne, you've stumped us.
Okay.
Jeez,
it's a state program that started maybe 6 to 8 years ago, and it's for public employees, and it's growing. I believe they're up to 28,000 members now.
You know more about it than we do. I don't like to say that very often on the show, but I'm sorry we can't give you some good answers about that. Catherine, I want to ask you about something that I think you were talking to NPR about. You said, and you alluded to this a few minutes ago, you said insurance companies have figured out how to make money on the policies that they've made available on the exchanges. What have they learned? What are they doing?
Well, I think that they've learned some more about their customers and have kind of a better handle on what some of their needs are and what, you know, how they seek care and what are the things they do. I think that a really key part of it has been network strategy. And I think that, you know, the companies that have succeeded in the individual market, a lot of them have sort of very narrow networks that are pretty tightly managed. I think we see a lot of the Medicaid MCOs in Minnesota. You have UCare and, you know, some of the other ones you might think about, like Centene or Molina, as sort of more national companies that have, as a kind of trademark strategy, a narrow network, a closed network, and really tight management of the network. And I think you can even see some of the blues that have succeeded in the market or doing better in the market are doing it with an HMO-like product, you know, with kind of a tight network. And then some of the, on the other side, some of the companies that really, you know, just kind of failed and sort of bailed out of the market have been some of the, you know, traditional sort of commercial insurers that tend to have a broad network plan, like, you know, United Health or Humana, et cetera. So I think that network is a pretty key strategy in the individual market because you really need to keep things as low cost as possible.
Yeah, Renee.
I agree that that's definitely one of the ways that the insurance market appears to be going. The challenge we have here in Minnesota is when the networks get too narrow, one of the things that can happen is a patient can be separated from their primary care provider. They can be, especially folks in greater Minnesota, they can have to drive hours as opposed to stay in their own town for providing care. And so that's one of the things that we've been concerned about, is that the networks can get so narrow that people who living at the extremes, yeah, whether geographic or economic, may not be able to have the same kind of continuity of care that other people
and
can.
And by the way, there's nothing that infuriates a patient more than being told, oh, you love that doctor? Well, they're not in the network, so figure it out. James says, mm-hmm, on Twitter, small business owner, $1,000 plus premiums, $1,000 increase in premiums, I think he's saying, $13,000 deductible in MinSure for a family of four, income over the subsidy limit. It's brutal. Promote the exchanges, spread the risk, see costs fall, basically opposite of the Trump administration and Republican ideas about what happened, what they predicted would happen. By the way, Catherine, I mentioned this train wreck head for a death spiral, which you heard a lot in the political.
Sounds like a movie.
It does. That hasn't happened. I'm not saying the ACA hasn't had problems. It certainly has. But the predictions of the train wreck and the death spiral have not occurred. Yes?
No, they haven't. And this year we can see the administration's kind of trying to take credit for the, you know, positive things that have happened. So I guess it's a little bit of, if you can't beat them, join them kind of approach. Because I think if you can't succeed in actually shutting off the supply of tax credit dollars, there's going to be a market, because there's a really, really strong demand for health insurance among people that don't have it and don't have an alternative way to get that. And I'm sure that Renee sees that all the time with her patients, just the real desperation to get health insurance. So as long as there is that tax credit money that makes the product affordable, even if there are a lot of things you can say about, you know, ways that you might wish this insurance were better or more generous or had more features, it's something that there's, you know, people are going to want to buy. And really, in a sort of unintended way, the way that carriers responded to the elimination of the cost-sharing reduction payments last year actually made a lot of the policies extra affordable for the subsidized part of the population. So I think that, you know, we did see a pretty steady enrollment, especially in the subsidized part. But your last caller was really talking about the kind of woes of the unsubsidized part of the market, which hasn't been as well served by the ACA, because the subsidies, you know, cutting off subsidies at 400% of poverty, you know, because healthcare is so expensive, which is what we've been talking about, it's really, you know, leaves people that are not wealthy in a place where they're basically being asked to pay kind of the full retail cost of healthcare, and it's just not affordable for a lot of people. Now, this year in Minnesota, things are a little bit better for that part of the segment, because, you know, the straight out premium decreases that you've seen in your state are helping people that don't get subsidies more than people that do get subsidies.
Got it. Call here from Justin in Winona. Hey, Justin, what are you seeing in your own household on this? Okay. To Marcia in Clear Lake. Hi, Marcia.
Hello.
Yeah. What's your experience with this?
Under the Affordable Health Care Act, my insurance for one single person went up to just under $800 a month with a $7,000 deductible.
Uh-huh.
Not at all affordable.
No.
I tried MinSure. I stayed on the line with people for several days. Couldn't get through. I'm using Christian Healthcare Ministries, which is a Christian sharing cost.
Hmm.
It's really affordable. It's $150 a month for the gold level. Deductible is $500 a month, and that can be negotiated if I go in and talk to my healthcare providers and they agree to give me a discount, as they just suggest we do with this ministries, and it's worked very well for me. I broke my hand last year, and everything was covered.
You know, I'm interested in what you said about not being able to get through to MinSure, because I know they've improved that a lot. Was that fairly recently, or was that at the very beginning?
That was at the very beginning.
Okay.
I thought, if they're this incompetent that they can't answer my phone call for 2 days, I don't want to trust my healthcare to them.
Yeah. I wanted to bring this up, Renee, that it got better. But what we've been saying about what the administration has done about making it more difficult to get information and even to enroll, we should mention a few of the things. I think they cut back the availability of navigators, right?
Yeah, the people who would basically help you through this.
Yeah.
And then also the level of advertising. I think their budget was $10 million for the nation. And our budget in Minnesota is like $8 million. So the idea that they're trying to actually advertise this would be considered a bit of a joke. But it's gotten much better. People have been able to enroll quite easily. There's a lot of support with the miniature program itself. And one of the things that I think people need to probably take into heart a little better, Minsure is not an insurance program. So I know she's like, if these people were incompetent in this way, they're not going to run my insurance. Minsure doesn't insure you. Minsure is a place where you can...
It's the vehicle, basically.
It's a vehicle
right?
for the private yeah. insurances and you to meet. And so they're not insuring you. They are giving you the access and the comparison ability to the private
But
insurance.
I do take her point as in, you're the portal that I get to yeah. the plans, right?
Yeah.
And if you can't get that right, and there were a lot of problems, but I think they're mostly solved. Catherine, isn't that true?
Yeah, I mean, I just have to speak up here.
Sure.
I mean, I have been taking a spin on all the exchange websites, you know, looking for what's going on.
Lucky you.
I do feel lucky. I really love it. But, I mean, Minsure just has some awesome decision support on their website. I mean, they have these fantastic scenarios in every rating area, looking at how the new rates are going to affect people in different, you know, family configuration and income categories. They have, a thing where you can look at the plans for 2018 and 2019 and see what, you know, estimate what your savings would be. I mean, it is really fantastic. And I think that they've done so much. They have things, you know, where you can respond about what medications you take or whether you think you have medium, low, high use of healthcare services to try to help you make the right choice. So, I mean, I would encourage the caller to take another look at Minsure and look what they can learn just on the website, because I think that there's fantastic information there. And also, I mean, most brokers, I think, in Minnesota and, mm-hmm. and other places are able to help people choose plans. They do get commissions, not very large ones, but they do get commissions. So I think that there are a lot of ways to get information about the plans. And, you know, for unsubsidized consumers, they're, you know, very, very likely to see a better choice this year than last year in Minnesota.
Dr. Deb Ditburner, a pal up in Alexandria, Renee, you know her too, right?
Yep.
She says, cost of medications and procedures is a huge cost driver. I will be a healthcare voter. If a patient has continuity for 3+ years with primary care cost, it goes down. We need primary care. You must speak on this since you're a primary family physician.
Yeah, and I would reinforce what Deb said 100%. The idea that continuity of care and having a primary, a patient-centered medical home where you have your primary care doctor that's yours, it takes 3 to 5 years for the return on investment to actually show up for the health system. But the fact is, Oregon just did a really nice study on, for every dollar we spend in primary care, in a continuity primary care practice for a patient, we save $13 for the whole health system. So the idea that health systems that are foundationally established on primary care means that they spend less money. They do fewer procedures, and they have better outcomes. Minnesota is the model that is used for a lot of places, mainly because we have such a very integrated primary care system here. And in Minnesota, primary care is family medicine. All of greater Minnesota is primarily served by family medicine doctors out there doing full-spectrum care. And the ability to hopefully help them keep the lights on is going to be an important part of the health system changes. But the fact is, it's cheaper and more cost-effective to have a primary care-based system. And that's why Minnesota, as challenging as it is, we have some of the best healthcare outcomes that there are.
Yeah, my mother lives in Arizona, and she's hearing from her physicians out there that Arizona's struggling with this. And if she has a daughter in Minnesota, this is where she ought to be getting her health care. Right. To the phones to Nick in Minneapolis. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
Hey.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks for waiting.
I'm a practicing physician, so I've got a number of opinions on these things. But I think one of the things, the issue is that the insurance is set up so that it's fairly punitive for people.
Uh-huh.
And rather than a $5,000 annual deductible that's just paid straight up, it would make more sense, and I think it would be better for the patients if it could be a percentage of each visit, for example, and if it's 10% of each occurrence or each visit until they get to the $5,000 rather than the full $5,000 up front.
Oh,
the other issue, I think, is that we need to incentivize the insurance companies to want to do the provide the preventative long-term care, as your panelists were talking about earlier. The way to do that is to get people to sign up for health care insurance for long-term. If an insurance company is only taking care of you for a year, they just want to see how little they can spend for a year. If they're taking care of you for 5 years, they want to make sure you don't have a heart attack during that period of time or a stroke, and preventative and wellness care will be taken care of.
So Nick, by the way, what kind of medicine do you practice?
Cardiology.
Okay. So are you suggesting some kind of incentives for making a long-term commitment to a particular plan?
Yes. Okay. I think you could incentivize it both ways. I think perhaps the government, in our government-supported programs, could say, if you're going to take this person on for 5 years, we're going to pay you X. And the insurance companies and the program should say, listen, if you're going to sign up for this care with this insurance company for 5 years, mm-hmm. we're going to give you a little bit lower.
Yeah.
We're going to give you a lower rate or a lower deductible or whatever it is.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Catherine, what do you make of that?
I mean, I think it's a great point. I mean, there's some segments like the individual market where that's just really tough because people are just in flux and moving into, you know, employer sponsored insurance or moving into other states. And so it's really hard to, you know, cultivate those incentives. I think one place where that really does work, you know, what the caller talked about, and I think it's really important, is Medicare Advantage, where I think carriers really get the idea that if they acquire a patient when they age into Medicare, there's a really good chance they can keep that patient. And there's a really good chance that patient's going to ultimately run the risk of getting expensive as they age. So there's a lot of reasons for carriers to want to manage care. And you can see so much interest in that segment. You know, I think people make money in it, and I think there's an opportunity to really manage care for that exact reason. So I think it is a really important point.
What do you think, Renee, about this idea of the percentage of the visits, and it isn't just one big lump sum that you owe at the beginning of the deductible period?
No, I think Nick has actually hit on a very innovative idea, and I think that's a lot of things that we have to look for is innovative and creative ideas. I mean, if a patient had to pay 10% of their visit, and it may even increase at some point, but they would still be able to come in and see us, and we'd be able to care for them so that things didn't get to the place where they're far more expensive.
You know, what I was getting at earlier, and I don't know that we really fleshed this out, was there were policymakers who believed that if you made the patient cost share, they'd manage their health care access better. I mean, and it seems like the numbers support some of that, but don't support some of that. You look skeptical on that.
Well, I've practiced medicine for 20 years, and I'm going to use diabetes as a perfect example. Diabetes and hypertension. I have patients who have both diabetes and hypertension, and they've known they've had it for 10 years. Now, if that person was looking to spend the least amount of money, they would not come see me. They just would not show up. And then one day they would show up in the hospital with complete kidney failure and need to be put on dialysis. And that's far more expensive than them coming to see me on a regular basis for the last 10 years. So that's what we're sort of looking at. If we're asking the consumer to make these decisions, then we look at them as consumers. But I do not look at them as consumers. They are patients, and they need to be cared for. And that's a long-term commitment.
Catherine, how do you see this?
Well, I mean, it's a tough issue. There's been a lot of studies that have shown that when people have high deductible plans, they will sort of equally forsake valuable and less valuable care, and they don't necessarily seem to make that distinction. And people have found that males are more likely to do that, and people have found that low-income people are more likely to do that. So that's sort of the argument against the high deductible plan. But then I would just say, well, what got us to this point to begin with is, you know, thinking about what's the alternative when you have a very, very high actuarial value plan where you don't have any reason to consider whether to have a visit or not. And, you know, then you can get into a situation where, you know, people are using care that they don't really need. And then, you know, that's something that's potentially a cost driver, too. So I understand the problem that the high deductible plan is trying to solve. But there's some, you know, definitely some things to be very cautious about and to think about with the high deductible plan and how it works. And that's why I think, you know, a lot of people have talked about sort of a value-based insurance design approach, which I think is some of what Renee's been talking about and also the caller, and also what we talked about earlier, which is, you know, structuring the cost sharing so that things like managing a chronic condition, things that are cost effective to be sort of on top of, those are things, or, you know, even your cost sharing for your medication to manage your hypertension or things like that, you know, structuring those payments so that people don't have disincentives to do things that right. keep them in better health and keep them out of the hospital later. So I think that, you know, if it's designed intelligently, there can be fewer of those kinds of disincentives.
Hey, I want to ask you both about a show we're doing tomorrow morning at 9 on single payer. Suddenly everybody's talking about, oh, it's Medicare for all and this is a great plan. Renee, do you have a view on the value of having a structure that's funneled through a single payer?
Yeah, I'd say that one of the things is we've done studies through our academy about single payer.
Mm-hmm.
And number one, you have to figure out what exactly it is you're talking
about. Because there's a lot of different elements of that, right?
There's a lot of different types of single payer programs. And the idea that a physician would be able to not have to worry about filling out 50,000 different forms for credentialing, 50,000 different forms for getting paid, the reduced administrative level of that is very enticing. The fact that every one of your patients would be covered is also very mm-hmm. enticing. The challenge is going to come in to how does that actually, what does the structure actually look like? But honestly, if you look at the rest of the world, the high-achieving countries have a more, less fragmented insurance payment plan. And I think that there's a big benefit in reducing the fragmentation and reducing the administrative over. I mean, we have in our clinic alone, we probably have a third of the people there that are just for billing and coding. They're not doing any healthcare. And that's typical across the entire country.
Yeah. Catherine, we will define the different ideas about what single payer can be. I'm interested in what you think of overall the way that some politicians are talking about these days is kind of the answer to the problems to the ACA.
Yeah. I mean, I think the ACA has made a lot of people feel committed to the idea of coverage for all mm-hmm. and that coverage should be real coverage and should, you know, cover people regardless of whether they have pre-existing conditions or whether they need expensive medications or they have healthcare needs that are actually way beyond their own ability to afford the care. I mean, I feel like we're kind of there, but then I think the next step is, you know, what is the best and most feasible way to really get to that place? And do you get to that place by actually having a system where you have, you know, a single payer? One interpretation of that is sort of that, you know, everybody pays into, let's say, the federal government, and then the federal government sort of leverages its purchasing power and, you know, becomes the buyer of healthcare and contracts with, you know, probably kind of a TPA function managed care company, and then, you know, who in turn is paying providers some kind of capitated rate. I mean, so what are the, you know, what are the advantages and disadvantages of something like that? And, you know, you can see some of the efficiency gains, you know, possibly, you know, mm-hmm. but you can imagine some disadvantages too. You can imagine providers not liking,
for sure,
you know, having that as their new sort of single overlord as the federal government.
Right.
You could make an innovation case about it. You know, you can make a fraud case about it. You know, there are a lot of things. There's no perfect system, you know, so I think that there's a lot of interest in, I think, sort of a mini version of that, which is kind of a Medicaid buy-in and sort of trying to use sort of publicly set rates for a larger share of the market. And I think that a lot of people see the appeal of that. But again, I mean, I think that the provider side is definitely going to see some disadvantages of that. So I don't think it's an easy thing to get to. But what I do like is I feel like increasingly people are on board with the idea that everybody should have access to affordable and comprehensive coverage. And now it's just a question of what's the best way to get there?
Hey, I know Susan from Minnetonka was holding on the line here for single payer. Susan, call back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock because I'd love to hear about your experience and your ideas about this, because that's when we're talking about it tomorrow. Renee, thank you. Always good to have you on the show.
Anytime,
thank
Carrie.
You.
Anytime.
Catherine, I hope you'll come back. Really good to have your policy insight as well. Thank you.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
If, by the way, you got in the middle of this show, lots of good information and feedback from listeners about how they're dealing with health care. Of course, you can always find it on the podcast when you have time to listen.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.